Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. K-System Stats is the first thing in the list today, and to be honest, I don't know a whole lot about it, and I'm not going to find out a whole lot about it, because it feels pretty straightforward, and I think I'm just going to have faith that it is as straightforward as it appears. So, according to the entry in /var/log/packages/ksystemstats-asterisk, it's a system stats is a daemon that collects statistics about the running system, as you might have guessed from the name. There are two binary executables distributed with this. One is kstats viewer, and the other is ksystemstats. So if I launch kstats viewer, nothing happens. Okay, how about --list? There we go. It shows a list. If you do kstats viewer --list, it gives you a list of available sensors. So these are, you know, I mean, not necessarily physical sensors, but they are. Is it fair to say it's an API to what's going on your system? So you could do, for instance, let's look at the OS kernel. OS/kernel is defined as kernel. Oh, here's something cool. OS system URL as operating system URL. And by URL, I mean URL. Just sometimes it's so much easier to say URL. Kstats viewer --details, I think, on OS/system/URL. So that, yeah, it was details. Okay. So it says OS system URL is http://slackware.com. Name, operating system URL. Short name, description, unit, minimum, maximum. Great. Not a whole lot of information there, but let's do OS/kernel. So kstats viewer --details OS/kernel. That seems to be taking a lot longer to gather information about, or I have done something wrong. All right. Control C out of that. Yeah, no, there's no detail with a capital K. I don't know why it's taking so long for that. That doesn't feel like it's working. No, that's not working. Okay, that's weird. Not sure why that's not working. Let's try something else really quick. Here's a kernel version. Oh, you know what? Maybe I was trying to look at something that was basically incomplete. Maybe I needed another slash. Okay, so OS/kernel/version. There we go. OS kernel version 5.15.38. I thought I was on 5.17. Either way, I should probably update eventually soon. So yeah, a little bit of information about that, I guess. That's kind of useful. What if we do kstats viewer --details network/all? No, that stalled out. I honestly think that there is a bug in this application that is causing it to stall when it receives only two slashes, or one slash rather, a value separated only by one slash. Because if I do, for instance, stats viewer --details CPU/CPU11 stalls out. If I do the same thing, CPU11/temperature, so that's CPU11/temperature for instance, then it gives me the name of the CPU, the name of the sensor, which is temperature, description, unit is in Celsius, minimum maximum 00, so I guess it doesn't know a whole lot about that, but the current temperature apparently is 46. I guess that's believable. Yeah, that's believable. Pretty hot to the touch, but not on fire. So yeah, this is strange. This is really, really, really weird that it doesn't seem to. What if I just do something? What if I do an asterisk so that I'm just giving it? No, it detects that that's not a real thing. So I can't just give it two slashes to convince it to go forward. Okay, anyway, that's kstats viewer. I'm pretty sure there's a bug in there, or you know, if it's not a bug the way I'm thinking it's a bug, then it's a lack of clarity about what the argument actually is supposed to be, which is a kind of bug. So The other binary, I don't know what it does. K system stats is actually, I think, K system stats is what it is named. And if you do a help, it tells you that you can dash dash replace and dash dash remain. But what actually happens is that K system stats, if you run it without any arguments, it does declare that it has loaded plugins, which map back to user lib64, and those are the entries for instance, ksystemstats_plugin_cpu.so. So these are all the Qt5 plugins listed in this package, but in terms of what it's actually doing, I don't know. Now, interestingly, there is a, this is meant to run as a daemon, as it says. So it is, it's running, it's doing something. There's a service file in user share, dbus-1 or something like that, for org.kde.ksystemstats.service. So it exists, it's humming away, it's working in the background. I just don't know where it's being leveraged, to be honest. I couldn't find it being linked against in, for instance, the what I would think would be the obvious place, which is K-Info Center, or it, at least I felt that was the obvious place, but apparently not. And then there's also Plasma-System Monitor, which I don't think I've gotten to yet in the official list, but I figured I'd check, and no, that's not linking to it either. So I'm not 100% sure where this is getting used. Potentially it's not, like, maybe it's a thing that developers are using, or, you know, some people are using to monitor their system, but it's not really that integrated into other applications yet. I don't know, not sure. So not a whole lot to say about that, other than the fact that I've already spent 8 minutes on a package that I said I'm gonna just skim over this one. So anyway, that was K-System Stats. Check it out if you're curious. I don't find it super useful, but it is an interesting curiosity item at the very least. Next on the list is KT Timer, and this one amuses me. I think I kind of get why it's a thing, but it is amusing to me. So anyway, it's called KT Timer, and it literally is a little timer for the brewing times of tea, and there are presets. So when you launch KT Timer from, like, your application menu, it launches, I think, straight to your system tray. I could be somewhat wrong about that. Maybe it's just launching there because I've already configured it, but it'll either launch to your system tray, or it'll offer you some configuration options and then go into your system tray. And the presets are black tea for 3 minutes, Earl Grey for 5, fruit tea for 8, and then green tea for 2. And whenever you want to start a timer, you just click on the tea timer. You don't click on it. You right click on it and choose from those presets, black tea, Earl Grey, fruit, or green, what timer you want to go to set off. So let's pretend like we're making green tea right now, just so we can see, we can witness this for ourselves, although I don't think you'll witness anything at all. But it'll give me a pop-up in, I guess, 2 minutes for when the green tea has brewed. But while it's doing that, I'm going to talk a little bit about this configuration item, the menu rather, and it's pretty simple. It's a configuration window that lists the presets that exist right now, and you can add to them. So for instance, I do actually happen to know that it takes 7 minutes for my electric kettle to boil water. So I'm just going to put boil water, and then I'll put 7 minutes here. And now I've got a preset for boiling water. You can also configure what action you want KT Timer to take when it's finished. And by default, it's pop-up message notification. You can also set it to auto hide the pop-up after 30 seconds, or remind you every some number of seconds. I'm not sure what happens if you turn pop-up off. I don't know how you would ever know that your tea was done, but I guess maybe you just look up at the icon, and if it's a certain color, then you know that your tea's done. I'm not sure. I ran out of things to say about KT Timer, so I had to pause my recording while I waited for the timer to come up, and then of course it chimed while it was paused, so you, dear listener, didn't even get to experience the audible chime of the KT Timer, but it's just the default KDE desktop chime notification thing, little ping that it does. So that's KT Timer. I can see this being useful to somebody, because in fact I can see it being useful for myself, because I will admit to being my office space is very close to my kitchen, and so I have possibly in the past I've gone into the kitchen, I've put some toast in the oven or started my coffee heating up or something and walked back into my office and then completely forgot about it. And 5 minutes, 10 minutes later, burnt toast is everywhere, permeating the air, and the coffee has reduced down to sludge. So not great. I could use that KT timer. In fact, I think as I'm saying it out loud, I think I'm going to launch it again and keep it handy because this is what I need in my life. Clearly, this is actually really, really useful. Wow, it really sold me on itself. I started that thinking it was just this charming sort of thing that British people must use to, you know, for their tea rituals. But no, I think this is an actual practical real life thing that many of us could use. So check out KT Timer. It's really, really useful, apparently. K Text Editor is next on the list. So let's go to var log packages, go for K Text Editor. Provides a powerful text editor component that you can embed in your application, either as a K part or using the KF5:: text editor library. The text editor component contains many useful features, from syntax highlighting and automatic indentation to advanced scripting support, making it suitable for everything from a simple embedded text editor, text file editor, to an advanced IDE. I feel like I've talked about this before, but maybe I haven't. This is the, in my mind, this is the selling point of one of the major selling points of KDE is the way that they structure these things. And I'm not saying other desktops don't do that. I don't know for a fact whether they do or don't. I've not looked that deeply into other desktops, to be honest, but I really love this about KDE, and you'll see it. You'll see it in Kwrite, you'll see it in Kate, you'll see it in Kdevelop. The same kind of features abound. And you think, why do these different applications even exist? They seem almost exactly the same. And I think you really see it, like, from Ktext, Kwrite. From Kwrite to Kate, you think, what's the difference? Like, Kate's just that much better, so why Kwrite? Why would that exist? Don't understand. And then from Kate to Kdevelop, you think, I don't get it. Kdevelop is basically Kate with, a bigger interface. Like, what's that for? But then if you look at Kwrite and Kdevelop, you know, you skip that middle one, you kind of skip from end to end, and you think, oh my gosh, they're completely different applications, but they're still using a lot of the same components. And I think that's that's a powerful feature. The fact that you can reuse this code to perform a common task, but you're reusing the code for different audiences. Because Kwrite, I mean, it's a beautiful little application. It's just a little text editor. I mean, that's really all it is. And yet, if you need more features, you can dig down into Kwrite and find the highlighting and the indentation scheme and the encoding and the mode that your text document is in. You can do all the stuff that you could in Kate, really. Like, there's not a whole lot of a difference. But then you open Kate, and while, yes, you are looking at the same, you know, you look at tools, and there's literally the same menu, mode, highlighting, indentation, encoding, all the same stuff. But then there's all this other, these other menus. There's an XML menu, and there are line numbers down the side, and there's tabs down the side, and there's a bunch of selections for, you know, the mode that you're in at the bottom of the screen, and what kind of tabs you're using, what kind of encoding it's in, and so on. So, and then you do the same thing with Kdevelop, and again, you'll find many of the same features, and yet the trappings around it are completely different, intended for a completely different use case, and it makes a big difference. And you can have those kinds of subtle changes because the main part of the application exists in Ktext Editor. There's no binary here. This is not text edit. This is the text editor. This is the thing that powers the other things. It's a bunch of header files, some CMake files, of course, and some translation files, and that's it. So very, very cool. And I think there are so many ways that I can imagine, I can envision sort of the act of personalized computing being advanced. And one of them, and they're not necessarily all sort of congruous or coherent with one another, but one idea certainly would be, well, what if we had these, you know, building blocks that people could assemble into applications that work well for them? And this is kind that this is kind of, it feels like that. I mean, it's completely different. I mean, this is still very advanced stuff. You're not going to find people dragging KText edit widget into their Excel spreadsheet to give them, you know, to build their application that they then export as an application and it launches magically or something. Like, you know, but this is a modular component to a much larger system that offers ostensibly really simple features. Like it's quote unquote just a text editing interface. Like that's not that big of a deal. And yet, as I've said, once you start putting it into different applications and framing it for different use cases, putting it into the hands of users, it's a pretty big deal. Okay. So that's what I have to say about that, which I realize isn't a whole lot in a way. I mean, all I've done is praise it without any specifics. And I'm trying to get away from doing that too much. But I don't know. There's something to that, because sometimes we flatten everything. You know, we look at it and we just think, yep, that's an application. It looks like a KDE application to me. But there's a lot more going on there. For instance, there's KText widgets. KText widgets is another set of header files that provides the KDE framework for useful text actions. So if you think of, for instance, the Linux terminal, then you might think, well, you know, you got great tools like find and grep and sed and awk and tr and iconv and so on. And if you kind of abstract that concept out to, well, what would be like the quote unquote commands that you would use within a text editing environment? And you and I, dear listener, can probably name a lot of them, like literally. We could probably, well, what do you mean? Like, why abstract that away? Like, there are literal commands that you can use for text editing, like sed, for instance, or awk, or Perl, or, you know, whatever you want. Well, tr, again, ed. So, yeah, there are. You can do that, but just for a moment, abstract it away and pretend like, well, if we had to come up with the equivalent of those commands in a graphical environment, what would those be? And they would be things like find and replace, find maybe regex. Well, actually, I'm making that one up now. No, I am not. Okay, cool. Regex. There's plural handling spin box. Don't know what that is. Replace. Forgot about that one. There's a bunch of different things. Oh, a find dialog. The dialog box to let you configure how you want to find and replace things. So those components of a text editor you would want in a text editor. And this library, or rather, no, actually, yes, I was correct. There are SO. There's an SO library here in plugins designer. So yeah, this library provides those kinds of, well, widgets, text widgets, so that people can use them for their applications, for their text editing applications specifically. So here's KTimer up next, and don't be fooled by KTimer. It is no tea timer. This is not a tea timer. I mean, I guess you could probably use it as a KT timer. Actually, you could. Let's re-implement KT timer in KTimer just for fun. So you launch KTimer. The top of it is an empty list, probably, unless you've used it before. And you can click the new button to create a new list item. And now you've got a list item. Now mine, for some reason, defaulted to 1 hour and 40 minutes. Maybe that's the duration that it's 1 minute and 40 seconds. Sorry, I'm off one field a little bit. So there you go. That's what it's doing. So I'm going to do, so I've got an empty list item at the top, and it shows me that there's a counter, a delay, a state, and a command. And the state is set to stop, or it's actually a square, but that's the stop symbol, because, you know, on a player, like, the triangle is play, two lines is pause, big square is stop. So that's the stop symbol. Counter and delay are filled in automatically as a minute and 40 seconds, probably the values that I left it in when I last used this application, and then command is completely empty. Okay, to fill in those fields, the bottom half of the application, the bottom half of this window, displays a settings and a state. And within settings is a line for a command. It's a command space line. KDialog-MSGBOX message box. And then space quote, T is done, close quote. Delay, let's just do it for maybe 23 seconds. There we go. That was right by my fingers. So that's what I've set it to. I could set it to loop. I don't want that. Start only one instance. Yes, that's checked on by default. Consecutive task. No, this is just, it is its own thing. Now the state box over here on the right is still in the stopped state. So now that I'm ready to start this thing, I'm going to click on the play button, and I can tell in the little box here that it is counting down. So I'm going to close that window. It's still active. It's up in my system tray, just like key. It's literally right next to KT timer. And in a couple of seconds here, a K dialog box should pop up and tell me that my T. Yep, there it is. T is done. So I'll click OK, and I've just re-implemented KT timer more or less in K timer. Okay, I'm going to remove that task. And that's all there is to it. I mean, that is what it is. It is a thing that you can use to create, to take action after some time of delay. And you can imagine that being useful for those one-off things that you're staying up late at night. You're just waiting for that one task to finish so that you can start this other one. Well, you could feasibly use K timer to, after 2 hours of waiting, then start this task or whatever. So that seems pretty useful, but that, it might seem useful. I don't use it myself, really. So, I mean, I've used it before, but not all that often. I mean, it's basically the at command, but in GUI form. Next up is K-Time Tracker. These are fascinating little applications. Now, I have friends who track time fairly rigorously. Sometimes I feel like I should, but I guess I've not really felt like I should strongly enough to actually try it. But there are people who do this sort of thing. And K-Time Tracker is an application intended specifically for that. Its little handbook is extremely well written. It is task-oriented. It you open the handbook and it states what the application is, and then it gives you scenarios. It gives you a problem. I'm a software developer and I need to time the amount of the time for how long I work on something on each project. Use K time tracker, and here's what you need to do. Problem: I'm a contractor and I can only spend 5 hours a day on such and such a task to stay within my billable hours. Here's what you can do. Problem: I am a freelance person and I have one project that I'll keep on desktop one and another project that I'll keep on desktop two, and I'll switch back and forth between them, and that'll dictate how things get, that'll mean that if I'm on desktop one, record time for this project. If I'm desktop two, record time for that project. Really, really cool stuff if you're into that sort of thing, which again, I'm not, so I don't do this actively, but having read the handbook, and it's so beautifully written, really is, and it's short. You click like three times and you're through. Well, six or something, but it's short. Really nicely done. So, I mean, granted, it's not a complex application, or at least from a user-facing perspective. So, you open up K-Time Tracker, and from left to right in the top toolbar. So, the first button is create a new top-level task. That's important. Top-level task is kind of a dummy task. This I find a little bit awkward, to be honest, but that's what you do. So you do a top level task and you name it. That's the project. So for instance, let's imagine that I've got a top level task and I say content creation. That's the top level task. Now within that top level task, I create in the next button over on the toolbar to the from left to right, create a new subtask in the selected top level task. So I'd have content creation selected, then I'd click create new subtask, record podcast. Okay. Start, mark that as done. And then maybe there's another thing that I have to do, which is, do the show notes, make show notes, which takes me, like 7 seconds in real life, but pretend I wanted to track that. So that would be another subtask of this content creation. Maybe I needed to record an episode of something for Hacker Public Radio. Subtask, record show for Hacker Public Radio, and so on. And then maybe I'd have a different task, a different top-level task of take a coffee break. And what are the steps there? Well, I have to go into the kitchen and I have to put on coffee on the little mocha pot thing that people call a mocha pot, that I call an espresso maker, and so on. So then once you're ready to start a task, you go to that task and you click the play button and it starts recording. It just starts tracking time. So now I am recording a podcast. I have been for 5 minutes, I guess, or since I started this. 5 minutes or yeah, I guess. Okay, 5 minutes. I mean, I started it and then restarted the recording. So that would be why, because I haven't actually been talking, I hope, for 5 minutes. I don't know. Maybe I have. Anyway, there you go. That's K Time Tracker. Now, if I wanted to say, okay, I'm done that task, then I could stop it and I can put a little check mark in the little auto-generated radio button or what it, check K check box. Yeah, that's what must be what it is. And it tells me how much of this task is complete. Well, now that I've done the check mark, it's 100% complete. And since that's the only object in, or the only task in this task, I can mark the task done. It gets a big green check mark. It gets 100% percent complete. And now I know. All that data is saved in a file, I think either as CSV raw or CSV that you can export from that data. I forget which, and I didn't bother trying it, but really nice. And then, I mean, like I say, for people, see, one of the common complaints I hear about this activity of sort of like tracking time is that the barrier to that is the having the wherewithal to reliably remember to go start a new task, or to tell your computer to start the new task timer. So the fact that it can switch back and forth between desktops seems really, really invaluable. Some people have told me, I know people who do this. So some people have told me that's not enough. That they need down to the application, and then other people say they need it down to the Firefox tab that is currently active, and maybe even more. Like, well, yeah, no, the tab would be the website that they're using, I guess. So yeah, people really, really sort of get into this sort of thing, and they want to see bar charts and graphs. And apparently there is some of that with this. I mean, first of all, you've got your automated desktop tracking. So, I mean, you could just create 16 desktops. They're free. Create 16 desktops, have your, well, I guess you could even do like, you know, your Firefox window with your email interface in it. Your Firefox window would be in desktop one, which you would then call email. And then you would do desktop two and call it LibreOffice. Desktop three, you would have, you know, something else. Well, maybe another Firefox window, and that one is pointing to your Kanban board. So, you know, like have it divided like that, and then you could switch between desktops, and KTimer would just be switching with you back and forth. And then at the end of the day, you could get an output of all of everything that you've been spending your time on. And oh, what I was trying to say too, I've got sidetracked there on the details. And apparently you can import this stuff into like KOrganizer and I think some other application, sort of like to interface with like a project management kind of framework. All of that is not something that I'm interested in, but I can 100% see where people, I know the type of people, I know the people who do this kind of thing and would love and could love that sort of framework. They would just have to switch from GNOME to KDE. That would be the hurdle to get over. Although, as I've demonstrated in previous episodes, I'm pretty sure, you can make KDE feel like GNOME, at least from my perspective. I know from probably someone who really, really uses GNOME all day, it's not at all correct, but I don't know. Anyway, K Time Tracker, very cool. I can really see people really, really getting into that. And I can see myself getting into that were I a freelancer. But now that I've made a task to go get coffee, I guess I kind of do have to go get coffee, or else I can't check that task as complete. So I'm gonna switch over to that task, and then I'll be back for the rest of the show. I was at a grocery store out of town the other week. We had gone, so over New Year's Day, the town that I live in lost water. It just ran out of water. It was a weird sort of infrastructure problem that hopefully is being fixed, but it was kind of a downer. And so we just drove out of town just because, I mean, what are we going to do? Sit around all day not being able to like have any water. So we drove out of town and just kind of made the best of it. And we ended up in a nearby town, and we went to the grocery store for something. I don't remember what, but I think, oh, water. Why? That's what it was, literally for water. So we went in for some backup water, because we ended up not having water for 2 days. So it was good to have actual water. So we got some water, and then I noticed that there was coffee, a big bag of coffee, really good coffee, on sale. I don't know why. It was just on sale. I mean, why would you put coffee on sale? Like, it's gonna sell. So, but I grabbed it, and it was like a kilo of coffee beans. And so now I've got something to contrast my sunshine blend with, which is nice. So I'm kind of switching back and forth between those two, so that my palate has to keep guessing as to what blend it's getting or whatever, what roast it's getting each time. And that has proven to be quite nice, actually. So I've got coffee. You probably have coffee. And now we're going to talk about listener email. This one is from Deep Geek. Deep Geek, you'll know from previous emails on this show. He says, first, regarding Linux documentation, I recently found that there's a program/project called TLDR. You should check it out. Essentially, once the client is installed, there's a database that's built, and you type in something like TLDR tar, and it gives you a page containing the examples of the most frequently performed operations, like tar x v z foo dot tar dot x z, for instance. So yeah, actually I know about that one, TLDR. I know that one. I know TLDR. TLDR. That's one written in Rust. There's cheat, and then there's also cheat. So I wrote a cheat program called cheat, and it was written. I wrote it because so many, many years ago, there was a cheat program with GitHub project, and there was, you know, the cheat application itself. I don't remember what it was written in. I think maybe Python. And then there was a repository of a bunch of just cheat sheets, just like TLDR. And they were just text files, like Markdown, I think, or maybe just text. I don't know. It wasn't like a database. It wasn't even as fancy as like a man page. You know, you didn't have to do any conversion whatsoever. It was just a text file. So recently, fairly recently, which, you know, I'm probably talking like 2 years ago recently, they switched from Python to like Go or something. And I have no problem with Go in theory. I just find, like, it's just a cheat command, right? So to me, I just feel like that's not really use. It's not really, that doesn't call for even Python, to be honest. I mean, it's just such a simple thing. And so I couldn't tolerate running a Go application called cheat. It just seemed too much. It was just too simple a request to require that many lines of code and compilation and all of that. So I decided to just re-implement it in Bash. And I mean, I think it's a find and a cat. It's nothing fancy, but that's what I wanted. I mean, you could probably even do it with less, really. I mean, we could say, well, let's just alias cheat to cat path name and then append whatever, you know, request. But I feel like I wanted something a little bit fuzzier. I wanted like a fuzzy search, maybe. That I could be making that up. It might just be a cat command, alias. I'm not sure. It's a really simple application. But yeah, I love these applications. Cheat, TLDR, 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 cheat. Those are great. Because honestly, I mean, look, I'm fine with the man the man pages system. I'm fine with the info pages system. I'm not fine with the fact that nobody seems to know what they're supposed to do. It's like we have great systems, but nobody has defined what the system is for. It's just, oh, you know, like documentation and stuff. What are we documenting? Are we documenting like the specifications of the application, or are we documenting how a user is expected to use it, or both? Like, what's the purpose? And we don't know. We still don't know. After decades and decades of Unix and Linux, we have no idea really what the man page is for. And you can tell me what it's for, but you're not, you know, you, like, we can't control what people put in their man pages. So even if we say, well, the man page is exactly for this, it's not meant for that. It's not a full document. You know, I've heard people say, well, it's not supposed to be full documentation. It's just supposed to be a reminder of how to use stuff. Okay, sure. Have you ever read the FFmpeg man page or the GCC man page? I mean, those are not just gentle reminders on how to use the application. So what I like about, and you know, and then some people say, oh, man page is for you know, X, but info pages are for Y. Okay, well, still, there's no real, you know, I just feel like someone needs to level set, like what everything is all about. And luckily, cheat and TLDR and those kinds of commands have come along, and they kind of know what they are. They're task-oriented cheat sheets. You're not going to look at a cheat sheet. Do I have cheat installed lately, or do I not? Let's find out. Cheat tar. I do. There we go. You're not going to look at, is this my cheat sheet? My cheat command? Let me do it. Which cheat? Yeah, it's in local bin. I didn't even realize I had it installed for some weird reason. Shows you how often I use it, I guess. Although I guess I'll take that as a compliment to myself. I mean, obviously, I just know these commands so well that I never have to use cheat. Yeah, actually, it's a more complex program than I realized. That's a little bit disappointing in a way, but I mean, it's fine. So there's a fetcher, there's a lister, there's a printer, and a helper. No, that's good. Yeah, okay, I'm okay with this. Actually, I like this code. I'm not. Yeah. And the thing is that you can get cheat sheets from various sources. So you can get the ones from the GitHub account of the, you know, the original cheat command or what I think of as the original cheat command. And then you can get stuff from other sources of cheat sheets. In fact, if I looked up where TLDR keeps their cheat sheets, I could probably integrate as long as they're in plain text format, I could integrate them into this command. So anyway, nobody's gonna look at cheat tar expecting to get a full explanation of all the different capabilities of tar and what kind of compression algorithms it uses and so on. What you're going to get is a rap sheet of every single of all the things that you would want to do with tar to extract an uncompressed archive. Tar XVF path to foo.tar to extract a tar in specified directory. Tar XVF path to foo.tar-C capital C path to destination, and so on. Now, I don't love these cheat sheets maybe as much. You know, if I'd written all of these, they'd be a little bit different. They wouldn't be using short options, for instance. They'd be using long options because long options, as I've said many times before, are self-documenting. They literally tell you what they do. Dash dash extract dash dash verbose dash dash file foo.tar. Well, that explains XVF a lot better and is a lot more, it's got a built-in mnemonic so that you don't have to refer to the cheat sheet so often. But anyway, I digress. So cheat commands, TLDR commands, we know what they are. They have clarity of purpose, whereas man and info, they're just so muddled. Nobody knows what they're really for. They don't know if it's the full specification document with the historical requirements document and the specifications of the application of how it works. And yeah, nobody knows what they're for. So I mean, it would be another thing. Heck, if we just said, okay, we're gonna do away maybe with the, maybe we could add some categories to the man system. You know, you have like, what is it, man up to man 9 for kernel routines or something, and maybe there could be like a man 10 for just the cheat sheets or something like that. I mean, that wouldn't exactly work, but I mean, at least, you know, I mean, you could say like man 10 for cheat sheets, man 11 for, you know, like a user manual style, like a handbook with all the context, and every capability of an application is recorded here, but look elsewhere for the thing that just tells you, you know, actually how to, what you're actually meant to do with it, or look elsewhere for the full specifications of like, of the requirements that the, that this application meets and so on. I don't know, something like that. Point is, I don't feel like man or info are well defined, and I think that cheat and TLDR just happen to be well-defined, and I love them. I think they're really, really useful, and I feel guilty sometimes for not writing more cheat sheets myself to add to the cheat infrastructure or the cheat and TLDR infrastructure. Okay, so anyway, DeepGeek continues. He says, I was very surprised that you thought Brad was wrong with his assessment that systemd was a move toward Windowsization of Linux. He is only slightly off. I rewatched Benno Rice's lecture, The Tragedy of Systemd, and found the needed factoid that Leonard Pottering admitted that it was a port of Mac's launchd functionality. As a former Mac user, I am sure you don't want to go back to the Mac ways, right? Remember that we are not just talking about an init system here. We're talking about adding a layer of global system operations to a Linux system that, without systemd, has only kernel and user space aspects. Systemd adds a system-wide functionality to change that to kernel, user space, and system layer functionality. So this is interesting, and I actually got another email from Brad here today. I don't know where it went at all. Here it is. So I got another email from him saying that, just wanted to clarify something. I don't fault anyone for liking Linux, and I still do use Linux at work. You said there was a through line with the direction Linux is taking. Unfortunately, with the ever-growing one process to rule them all mission creep that is systemd, I honestly believe that through line points directly towards Windows. More and more and more things are falling under the systemd umbrella, and I recall hearing Leonard Pottering in an interview with Chris Fisher say that systemd wanted, quote, to own, well, is this a quote or is this a quote? Is this a paraphrase? Brad does not specify, so I won't say quote, but he said that systemd wanted to own everything between the kernel and the application layer. Add to that the fact, there's no close quote there. So add to that fact that he left Red Hat and went to Microsoft, some conspiracy theorists would say back to Microsoft, that he is an agent provocateur. It all points to a rather disturbing picture, and the at times poorly coded software that either crashed, didn't work, or thumbed its nose at the Unix way of doing things. XX is a broken concept, so I fixed it for you. You can thank me later. Pushes Linux into the realm of Microsoft software reliability, and I have been working with Unix for almost all my adult life and have been a professional Unix sysadmin for nearly 30 years, and I like the Unix way. Kudos to others that like the new face of Linux. It's starting to feel almost as alien as Windows to me, just attempting to explain what's going on inside my head. So, this is all really important context, for me at least. This is actually probably the most lucid conversation about systemd between Brad and DeepGeek, their emails. This is the most lucid email or conversation about systemd I have had since systemd first burst onto the scene back in, what would it have been, like 2000, I don't know, 9, 10, something like that. Is that right? Maybe earlier than that, 2007, 7 or 8, probably. So, I don't know, whatever it's been, right? So literally for a good, let's call it 12 years of intense, like sort of controversy, I feel like this is the most rational conversation I've had about it. Not for lack of trying, by the way. It's just I do not find the discourse about systemd that happens on the internet to be very useful almost ever. I just don't. So I appreciate this conversation immensely. I feel like this is an invaluable conversation because this separates now what the problem actually is. What I'm getting from this conversation, and I don't think I'm misunderstanding anything, but what I'm getting here is that some people don't like systemd based on the design, the prospect of the design that it is sort of bringing to Linux, like the architecture, the system design itself, while other people like systemd for the functionality that it provides. Now, I feel, and I might be cheating here, I might be trying to straddle a fence that unfairly. Although to be fair, I guess I am straddling that fence. I have a foot in the systemd field, and I have a foot in the outside of systemd field here. So you know, this is a sort of a, it's kind of a cowardly stance in a way. I'm getting, and I've said this several times before, right? I'm getting the benefits of System D in some places, and then I'm enjoying my freedom from System D in other places. And if I cared more personally, I would probably take a firmer stance. I would say, well, I'm a Slackware user. I don't mess with System D, and so get it out of my system. But in reality, I use Slackware on all my personal things. And then when I boot a Raspberry Pi or something, you know, it's booting CentOS or Fedora or whatever non-Debian variety of system I can find. Or if it is doing Debian, then System D is still there. So I'm enjoying like the benefits of it over here, but not over there. So anyway, what I was trying to get to there. So I feel like when I'm using System D, I very much enjoy all of the features that it provides me. I really do genuinely enjoy it, especially with all the container stuff happening right now. It's just, it's brilliant. It's so nice. It is so smooth. And previously, I honestly literally thought that people were upset about System D because of the fact that they had to do these new kinds of files called service files or whatever they're called in System D. The system unit files, whatever they, yeah, unit files, I think. And I never really understood why that was such a big deal. It's a plain text file. You can write it yourself. You put it into a folder and it works just like any other config system. I didn't understand what the problem was. But that was one of the main things that I heard problems about, other than the fact that just System D just had too much going on in it. But between Brad and Deep Geek, I'm getting now that, I knew that there's this idea that, well, but Linux, it does one thing and does it well, and System D does two things and doesn't do either of them well, that sort of thing. I've heard that enough. I get it. But this point here, that Deep Geek makes, we are talking about adding a layer of global system operations, which I don't know what that means, to a Linux system that, without System D, had only a kernel and user space aspect to it. And that's really clearly stated, actually. Like that statement right there, I kind of wish people had said that a lot more back when this was a very, very hot topic. Because that's something there. Adding a layer of global system operations to a Linux system that otherwise has only kernel and user space. Now, whether that's a problem or not is up to the user, like kind of like what Brad was saying here. I mean, like, if that's what you like, if you're okay with that, then I guess you're okay with that. Look, my personal biggest, I don't care if there's a global system operation to a Linux system, honestly, at least not that I know of. I don't know that I care. And the allusion to Max Launch D, I get that. I do. And I've known that for actually a long time. I guess I should have mentioned that or something. I don't know. I mean, yeah, I know that it's like Max Launch D. I really do. I honestly do. I mean, I believe that's even why he called it System D. I think that's what the D at the end, I mean, yes, also for Daemon, but also I think that was not I think there's a similarity there. But in terms of, yeah, okay, so it's Launch D likes functionality, but I mean, once again, like, if it's working and it's open source and it's improving user experience, I'm not feeling the contention there. Like, that doesn't bother me personally. And I 100% get that it might bother other people. And here's the thing where I'm being probably disingenuous as well, or maybe I'm not being disingenuous, but I'm not taking a firm stand on saying I am really, really against System D, then I am probably opening myself up for sadness later on. And I may be really sort of luxuriously letting other people sort of brush away the things that I don't want to have to deal with. So here's what I'm saying. I'm fine with system D on some systems, right? I don't see the problem. I don't care if it's like Mac Launch D. It's working. It works well. It is, and it is fully open source. So I don't have a problem with those. That list of requirements is, that's pretty much what my requirements are. So at least that's what I tell myself my requirements are. Because once again, I'm on Slackware. And I can't imagine not having Slackware on a computer. So, you know, one thing I'm saying, one thing I'm doing. So anyway, systemd, it's there, it's working, it's open source, right? It is open source. That's the key for me. That's like really, that shouldn't be the last line item. That should be the top. Number one, is it open source? Yes. Okay. Does it work? Yes. Is it improving user experience? Yes. Is it making my job easier? Yes, yes, yes. So it's there. But one of the things that I love about Linux and about open source is the choice, right? That's a huge, huge part of open. I mean, it's huge. I mean, it's probably the hugest thing about open source. I mean, just the fact that we get to choose how we do things. So the one lingering sort of fear that I have about systemd for myself is the elimination of choice. Like the more systemd grows, the and the more things hook into it, potentially the fewer choices we have for Linux, right? And the thing that has kept me rather sort of benign on the topic is that I've heard that for 12 years and I have yet to see it. Now, like I say, maybe I'm allowing the invisible kernel init system elves solve everything for me. But I'm just blindly sort of like blissfully saying, systemd is not really causing that much of a problem. Because look, I'm on Slackware, I don't have systemd, and I have everything I could ever want, including flat packs for easy installation of big gargantuan applications like Kdenlive Live. So maybe, you know, the fact that some programmer somewhere is hacking around, you know, and creating shims for things that are hooking into systemd, and they're making it so that it still runs anyway. Maybe that's a thing. I don't know. But for me, that's the one lingering fear I have about systemd. It's just that it could at some time sort of eat the choice part of Linux, and that would be on some level a deal breaker for me. And when I say deal breaker on some level, I do mean a deal breaker on some level, because personally, like Linux is doing everything I could ever want it to do at this point in my life. Like it is exactly, I mean, it's been there for a long time, but I mean, after you do it for a lot of years, you're just like, oh, I think this is really, really exactly what I want out of a computer. Like it really, it has a cumulative effect. And so I'm pretty darn happy with it in terms of like the little multimedia projects that I get up to and the coding projects that I get up to. All the things I do on Linux are the things that I want to be able to do. And systemd's never slowed me down yet. Not having it hasn't slowed me down yet. And having it hasn't slowed me down yet. So I don't know. I'm not seeing the difference personally from my perspective. If other people are, and I believe other people are because two of them have just emailed me, then I think that's a fair critique of systemd. And, you know, once again, I mean, in a not confrontational or sarcastic or dismissive way, I think that it's really, really good. Like I'm being legitimate here. Like it's really good that we have alternate, really strong alternate operating systems, open source operating systems, in case you are the tinkerer who just cannot, for whatever reason, appreciate the fact that there's a new layer, you know, between that kernel and that user space, that there's a global system operation layer or you know, component to the Linux system, then you can use something different. And I think the really, really concerning thing for me would be if there was no Linux that could exist without systemd. I think that would start to concern me a little bit. But even that, to be honest, I mean, systems and system design does evolve, and it should evolve. And so even that, I think I don't think that would be a necessary. I would have to look at it. I'd want to see it. I could be just on the slow slope down. You know, who knows? Like, maybe I'm not taking this seriously enough. But after 12 years of hearing about System D or whatever it's been and not seeing the sort of the problem, I have a really hard time getting on sort of a position where I fear it or I don't appreciate it, strangely enough. I mean, I do. I feel, because a lot of people that I respect, two of whom just emailed me, say, you know, System D, not a good idea, bad design. And yet, you know, I don't know. What can you do if you're not feeling it, you're not feeling it. And I'm just not feeling it still. So I don't know. Really absolutely fantastic conversation though. And I thank both Brad and Deep Geek for engaging me on that, because as I said, and I'll just say it one more time real quick, that was the most useful, the most lucid, clear, enlightening conversation about System D I've ever had. So thank you. Like, again, in 12 years, that's the best. Okay, so I think that's about everything. I mean, that took up the entire second half of the show. So I guess that was really good listener email, hopefully. Hopefully you got something out of it, dear listener, or found it at least enlightening or somewhat interesting. So thank you very much for listening, and I will talk to you next week.